Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Port of Harlem Talk Radio, and I'm your host for this show and also publisher of Port of Harlem Magazine at portofharlem.net. If you're listening via the internet, you can type your questions in the comment box. You can also call and listen by dialing on your phone 516-531-9540. And if you want to ask a question, after you are connected, press 1 and please be in a quiet place. You can also visit portofharlem.net and click Port of Harlem Talk Radio from the menu to hear this and past episodes. We are also available on about 7 podcast platforms. And lastly, We Talk Production sponsors Port of Harlem Talk Radio. Kevin Magruder, author of From Philip Payton, The Father of Black Harlem, is our guest today. He talks about Payton and his impact on Harlem and the world. Magruder is also Vice President of Academic Affairs and Associate Professor of History at Antioch College. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to the program.
Well, you know, it's a pleasure to have you after all these years to actually have this type of conversation with you. And I'm going to go back to 1990. In 1991, you were owner, manager of Home to Harlem, the gift shop. And from 2008, co-owner of Harlem Made Style Shop. So, Kevin, were you born and raised in Harlem? And if not, what attracted you to Harlem?
I was born and raised in Toledo, Ohio. But
kidding.
I moved to New York. Yes.
you are a Midwesterner.
I am. And I'm back there now. But I moved to New York in 1982 to go to Columbia Business School, and I got my MBA in real estate finance in 1984. But the first week I was in New York City, I went to a lecture at Hunter College, and it was about LGBTQ people during the Harlem Renaissance, and it was given by a man named Eric Garber. And I just got very interested in Harlem's history, started, even while I was in business school, started reading up a lot. A lot of the Harlem Renaissance books were being republished in the 80s and 90s. And so I pretty much read all of the, you know, the major Harlem Renaissance works while I was in business school. So I came and then started doing walking tours of Harlem for the Black Business Students Association at Columbia. And when I graduated, lived a year in Brooklyn, and then Brooklyn was not hot like it is now. And then moved to Harlem and ended up living there for 25 years. And, you know, the business you mentioned, Home to Harlem, that was an idea that, you know, just came to my head because I was watching tourists kind of stumble around in Harlem, figuring out where they should go. And because I had the business school background, a friend of mine from business school helped me put together a business plan. And I knew some people from community development work I was doing, and a man named Curtis Mills, who owned a building at 125th and Fifth Avenue. I think he kind of recognized my entrepreneurial spirit. And so he told me he had a space in his building, and I went in there and opened up in August of 1990.
Yeah, I remember Home to Harlem for several reasons. Number one, I think about that time, I was into watching these old movies, or somehow they were available and I saw them. And there was a movie called Home to Harlem. Is that correct?
Yes. That name comes from the name of Claude McKay's 1925 best-selling novel, which is about a group of friends in Harlem. And I did a lot of events at the store twice a month. And the first event I did was with a man named Carl Cowell, who was about 90 years old then, and he had been Claude McKay's literary executor. And so he was about to come out with a book called Harlem Glory that Claude McKay wrote. It was a novel that was never published during his life. And so we did a launch of that probably in September of 1990 with Carl Cowell as the main speaker.
Okay. Well, both of those shops, Home to Harlem and Harlem Made Style Shop, at some point distributed Port of Harlem Magazine. And so that's for all of you, that's our intersection.
Definitely.
Port of Harlem. And like the magazine, the stores had a sense of history to them. And this is back when we were in print. So the both the stores, again, had a penchant for an appreciation of history. That was no accident, was it?
Oh, no, not at all. History became my hobby. While I was in business school, and then after I graduated, I just started reading up more and more about African-American history, and particularly in Harlem history specifically. And so both businesses came from that point of view. The second business, Harlem Maid Style Shop, if people have seen the movie that's just out now, the Harlem Cultural Festival, about the Harlem Cultural Festival from 1969, my store, Musa Jackson, actually, who begins and ends that, he's the person talking at the beginning and end of the movie, he used to come into our store all the time. Because we were about two blocks from Mount Morris Park where that festival happened. I had two partners, Murphy Heiliger and Patricia Alford. And Murphy really had the idea for the second shop because he's a graphic designer. So we sold T-shirts that he designed, but also had historical books and photo books, things like that. And by that time, I had already decided to go back and get a doctorate in history. So I was doing that while I was operating the store, working my way through the City University of New York Graduate Center doctoral program. And my dissertation, of course, was on Harlem, looking at...
you said, of course, right?
Yeah, which I knew going in, I was going to do something about Harlem, and I just wasn't sure. So I looked at, it turned out into a book that came out in 2015. It's called Race and Real Estate, Conflict and Cooperation in Harlem, 1890 to 1920. And it looked at how Black people became anchored in Harlem from that period, 1890 to 1920, by purchasing property. And also looked at the various responses from white residents of Harlem during that time, that a lot of people are familiar with the hostility that came to Black residents, but there was some cooperation from white people too, because they worked with them, sold them property, took back mortgages, which people who are hostile don't do that. And so I tried to uncover a more complicated story about that time than typically has been written.
So while you're doing this, doing your work, is that how you came to learn about Philip Payton?
I knew about him long before that. Before going back to school, I was working in housing development, particularly with the Abyssinia Development Corporation. I was director of real estate development there from 1991 to 1996. And one of the first major developments we were doing was on 131st Street between Lenox and Fifth Avenue. And that's the block where Payton lived. And so his name, I knew it, even, Harlem history typically mentioned his name, and I knew his building was on that block, and I even met the person who had owned his building, was vacant at the time. It was a man named Robert Pugh, and he was a Black man who owned a monument company, and he was interested in renovating the building, so I tried to work with him on that, but I knew Payton from that time. And then when I was doing my dissertation, I found a lot more information about him. And since the dissertation wasn't only about him, it didn't make sense to put all that in. And so after the Race and Real Estate book was published in 2015, I decided to return and really focus on Payton for the follow-up book. And that's what Philip Payton, the Father of Black Harlem, is the follow-up to that.
And who are you working for? What development corporation are you working for?
Abyssinian Development Corporation, ABYSSINIAN. It's associated with Abyssinian Baptist Church. Pardon?
Yeah, the more famous one.
Yeah, it's associated with Abyssinian Baptist Church. Adam Clayton Powell Sr. was pastor there from 1908 to 1937, and then his son was pastor from 1937 to 1972. And during most of that time, Adam Clayton Powell Jr. was also a congressman representing Harlem. And really, when he first came into office in the 40s, he was only the second Black congressman. There was another one from Chicago. But a lot of people across the nation look to him for civil rights legislation. And so it, you know, it's a well-known church. And in the 1980s, they started a development corporation, and I was part of the group of volunteers that got that started. And so then in 1991, I went on staff full time there.
Yeah, I guess they did a lot because they got a lot of publicity for achievements.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some, you know, kind of a mixed history because as Harlem has gentrified, a lot of the things that were being done, they're not a presence in pushing back against that in the way that I had hoped. I'm still a member of that church, and you know, so I'm, you know, very interested in that, not my own personal legacy, but the legacy of that organization. And because I thought it had a lot of potential, but it met with challenges that many nonprofit organizations in neighborhoods that are changing often end up getting challenged and, you know, really trying to figure out how to stay true to their mission. And
I guess sometimes the other forces can be larger. And I think maybe that's what Philip Payton had come up with too. We're talking about Philip Payton in particular, but before we talk about Philip Payton in particular, what kind of research did you do to pull his life together into a book?
Some of it, I followed a foundation that I did with Race and Real Estate. The book that preceded it was using the public real estate records at the city register's office in New York. So every county in the country, if you buy or sell property, it's going to be registered by, typically it's a county recorder, but in New York, they call it a city register. And so you can find out information about property as public records. And so I use those as the core. And then census records, you know, I knew a fair amount about the people during that time, and I could recognize names, but sometimes if you need to figure out the race of a person, the census records, basically now through Ancestry.com, is a really good resource. And then newspapers. Payton was a genius in terms of marketing and promotion, and he used the newspapers a lot. He had a really close relationship with the editor of the New York Age, and later in his work, Fred Moore, who was the publisher and editor, was in the leadership at the Afro-American Realty Company that Payton ran. And so a lot of Payton's activities were promoted there. He advertised regularly. And he also shaped the narrative on what he was doing. And so all of that was in the newspapers. And then some personal papers. He was in Booker T. Washington's inner circle. And so looking at Booker T. Washington's papers at the Library of Congress, he was good friends with Emmett Scott. And so I was able to look at Emmett Scott's papers at Morgan State in Baltimore. And those are really the main resources. There, I was not able to find any business records that survived or personal papers of Payton. So I tried to find him in other people's correspondence. And in the secondary literature, a lot of books talked about him. But also the real estate publications. At the time that Payton was active, in New York, he was active from basically 1900 to 1917, right until the week of his death, he was doing something. And the real estate paper or journal at that time was a weekly called the Real Estate Record and Builder's Guide. And so every week they list any transaction that happened. And also sometimes they had letters to the editor. Payton used that journal to respond to critics of his, and then the New York Times as well. The New York Times also at that time listed every real estate transaction, and both of those publications are digitized now, so it's, you know, pretty easy to just search and see what he was buying, what he was selling. There were some situations where he had fines on property that he owned, or at least all of that's there. And so it was really kind of bringing that data together and then deciding what is the story here and, like, what does this mean?
Exactly. You seem like the perfect person to do that with your background and your interest. So I think the story must be very – I didn't get the chance to read everything, but the mm-hmm. things that I have read, it was very interesting. And one of the things that – or the tagline that I read and that we keep using is that white investors had purchased a building where blacks were just beginning to move into, I suspect. And then they gave them eviction notice to get rid of them because I guess they wanted the neighborhood to remain white.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of crying – go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I guess instead of crying about it or protesting, Peyton and his people went and started buying up the properties or buying up the leases and then make them available to black people. Is that the story?
Yeah, there's another layer to it. For those who know Harlem, black people have been in Harlem since the 1600s when the Dutch controlled it. And so it's not that there were never black people there. And
okay.
By the 1890s, it was a small number that was there. By the 1890s, they were on three blocks, 135th, 134th, and 133rd Street between Lenox and Fifth Avenue. And I have a map in, I think it's in this Peyton book, it's in the Race and Real Estate book. It's an automobile club in the 1920s. They printed a map of Harlem, and they called those three blocks Little Africa. And so they had designated that as the black area. What you're describing is a situation where the Hudson Realty Company, which was a white company that was led by some of the old families in New York, the Morgenthau, Maximilian Morgenthau was one of the people. His brother eventually becomes a diplomat during the FDR administration. And one of the Bloomingdale's of the Bloomingdale department stores, they had formed a company in the 1890s. And by 1904, the first subway line, the Lenox Avenue line, was scheduled to open in October. In the spring of that year, they began buying vacant property and some occupied property in that same area, that 135th Street area. And in the spring, then they serve eviction notices on the tenants in those buildings. And not all the buildings were black, but many of them were. And so, like you were describing, the black people did complain. And I haven't been able to figure out if they actually got evicted or not. But whether they did or not, Peyton and other black investors counter by buying other properties in that area. And it's kind of like a chess game where Hudson Realty moved to evict. And then Peyton and J.C. Thomas, who is a major undertaker, and a few other people, they buy properties adjacent, and they block what Hudson Realty is trying to do, because what they were trying to do is assemble all of that land so they could redevelop it, because now that the subway is going to be open with a stop right at 135th Street, I'm sure they wanted to have a better, what they considered a better use than these 3- and 4-story walk-up apartment buildings occupied primarily by black people. The reason they had allowed black people to live in that area is because they charged them higher rents. And so they had created a segregated market. They knew black people didn't have a lot of options, and they were fine with black people being on those three blocks when they could charge higher rents. But they probably felt that they could get even more revenue from a different kind of use there now that the subway is going to open. And so that incident really kicks off Philip Peyton's career in terms of a public career, because he was already doing things in real estate. But by the summer of 1904, he incorporates the Afro-American Realty Company and announces it. And he has a prospectus that announces that it's going to be a race enterprise, and it's going to do away with what he called Negro colonization. And he's going to make the color line costly for white owners. And the New York Times writes about that because he catches their attention. And they have a op-ed about it where they say his plan is a mistake because black people won't be able to afford these buildings. And so it kicks off the next 13 years of kind of a battle for who's going to control Harlem.
Wow. And the backdrop of modern gentrification, which I see this as another determinant as to who will live, where, and it's similar to these evictions blacks were receiving in Peyton's time, I was amazed that Peyton and others had a financial strategy versus a social strategy to fight back. As a person who has had a career in community development, are there people today with such economic responses to others determining where people can live? Black people in particular.
Yeah, there are in New York and other places as well. So what Peyton, like you said, he organized economically. It definitely was a race enterprise that he promoted it as something benefiting black people. And so I see that in various places, in New York and other places too, where there are black developers who Peyton, he was a real estate broker. He bought and sold buildings. I haven't found any evidence that he actually built buildings or developed them, although his incorporation of his company, it included that activity. But I haven't found any evidence that he did that. But now there are some black developers doing that. New York is kind of strange in some ways because as long as there's been a black entrepreneurial class there, there really are not a lot of big developers. And you look at other cities like Atlanta, Chicago, there are some big developers, sometimes multi-generational, and you really don't have that in New York. There are some developers on the scene now, but they're for the most part first generation. And because real estate, you need so much capital to do things, even if you're borrowing, having that multi-generational wealth really puts you in a stronger position, and that's why the race disparity in terms of being able to, you know, kind of control how a neighborhood is going to be developed is often not in the hands of black people. In the 80s and 90s, in many cities, nonprofit development corporations were major players. The market in some cities has changed now. So, you know, I'll talk specifically about New York. They're still there, but it's much more challenging now. And so there's definitely parallels in terms of the response that Peyton had to what people are doing today.
Because I would love to know more specifically about an organization in any city that's responding the way he did.
I think that even if you look at the young man who was killed in L.A., I can't think of his name now. He was a rapper, but he had bought property. He bought a block there, and so
This
is happening. It doesn't. You know, they don't necessarily do it with the flourish that Peyton is doing it, so we don't necessarily know across the country that that's happening. But it is definitely, you know,
okay.
it's definitely happening. I mean, Peyton, there were also, you know, some drawbacks to what he did in that his announcement said he was going to, when he talked about ending Negro colonization, he said that there's no reason why white and black people can't live in the same apartment buildings. And that was already happening to some extent in 1904 in New York. Not, you know, it was unusual, but it was happening. But as he begins to get control of property that's occupied by white people, rather than do that, he evicts the white people and puts in black people. And on the one hand, for black people who were living in like the Midtown area, the Tenderloin, roughly between 23rd and the high 60s, the attraction to Harlem is Harlem was new. Most of those buildings are built in the 1880s, 1890s or later. And so they're not getting old rundown buildings. They're getting well-constructed buildings that are quite new. But they're also charged more than the white people who Peyton evicted. Peyton charges them more and makes all the buildings all black. And so he misses an opportunity to do what he was going to say, what he said he was going to do. And I, well, that was one of the questions that I was trying to answer in writing this book, understanding, okay, he said he was going to do this. Why didn't he? And I believe the reason is what we were just talking about in terms of capital, that Peyton, he was from an entrepreneurial family. His father was a barber. His mother was a hairdresser. Grew up in Westfield, Massachusetts. They were relatively well off, but not the kind of wealth that they could finance his work. So he really is kind of starting on his own. And I think the allure of that higher revenue from charging black people higher rents was too attractive for him to pass up. And so what he ends up doing is reinforcing the segregation practice that he said he was going to break. And there's a mixed story there. Because that happens, it lays the groundwork for a strong black community that's the foundation of the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s, that I think black people might have moved to Harlem at some point, but not necessarily between 1904 and 1920 in the large numbers that they did. And if they hadn't, you know, we might be talking about a Negro Renaissance, but Harlem might not have been the center of it. And so that, you know, a black culture point of view, his actions have a positive effect in terms of what happened. But if you look at the 30s and how Harlem is hit so hard by the Depression, that has a lot to do with concentrated poverty because it's so segregated. So unemployment is at 50% in the black community during the Depression. It's at 25% nationwide. If Harlem had been more integrated, that high unemployment rate might have still been the same, but it would have been dispersed across the city. And so maybe we wouldn't have had the Harlem riot in 1935 that is a reaction to police brutality that people were, or we might not have even had the police brutality, because what happens is black people are steered to Harlem, and then the things that happen that go with that happen as well. Police corruption, high crime, illegal activity because the police are corrupt. And people identify that with blackness when it's really ghettoization, that when you confine people to one place, that's the advantage of what people are doing. And I'm not saying that Peyton did all that, because he died in 1917, so he didn't live to see any of that. But he did play a role in setting those things in motion in a way that I'm sure he didn't envision.
That makes perfect sense to me, and it sounds like this is in our last 90 seconds, it sounds like this is a good book for urban planners to read. What do you think?
I would recommend it. Definitely.
Because a person who's interested in urban planning or planning in particular, it sounds like something that I should read. And the whole idea of a person using capitalism and finances to fight back is something that I would love to know more about.
Yeah. Yep. It is definitely, somebody today could use it as a manual of what's possible. And like I said, there are people doing this in different parts of the country, and using economic development in a way as an empowerment tool.
Okay, so does he have family left?
Distant family. His two brothers died before he did. He had a sister who lived in the 60s until the 50s. None of them had children. On his father's side, there is some family. I haven't connected with them. And that was one of the reasons why I think the records, I wasn't able to find them, because if there were closer family members, I think I would have been able to maybe find them. They might have survived. They may still be somewhere, but I just wasn't able to find
them.
Okay,
Kevin. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And we'll love to plug this. Okay, thanks so much. Great book.
Thank you.
All right, take care. The great book for number one.